So we'll begin our panel. I'm just gonna, can everybody hear me? Okay. So I'm just gonna quickly introduce the panel. We have Dr. Christina Fink, who's a graduate of Stanford and Berkeley and a current professor of practice in international affairs here at the George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs. She's a cultural anthropologist and has worked extensively with Thai and Myanmar-based civil society organizations and as a consultant to international development organizations. In 2009, she authored the book Living Silence in Burma, Surviving Under Military Rule, and more recently, she has published journal articles and chapters on many topics affecting Myanmar. We also have Matt Wells, who is a graduate of Harvard and Rice University, and currently a senior crisis advisor at Amnesty International, where he undertakes human rights investigations in situations of armed conflict and major crises. With over a decade of experience leading human rights investigations across Africa and Asia, particularly focused on mass atrocity crimes, he has recently been concentrating on Myanmar Rohingya crisis. Robert Morrow has served the U.S. State Department at many U.S. embassies overseas before returning to Washington as director of all U.S. commercial operations in Africa, Near East, and South Asia. He was awarded a silver medal for managing the aftermath of the bombing of U.S. Embassy in Nairobi and is now consulting in international business and government affairs in Middle East and Asia and representing the Burma Task Force in D.C. Please give them a hand. So first, before we open it up to Q&A, I would like each of you to please discuss any points from the film that stood out to you specifically and kind of briefly link what you have been working on or thinking about with this issue to what you kind of saw in the film. So would you like to start, Dr. Pink?
Sure.
Thank
you. Okay, so I think the date of the film was maybe 2016, early
yes.
2016. So a lot has happened since then. They were talking about the attack on one particular village and whether that happened or not. I mean, in the scale of things today, that almost seems meaningless because since then, there have been two major exoduses of Rohingya from Rakhine State. The first in October, November 2016, and then again in 2017 around the same time. In both cases, those were precipitated by an armed attack by an armed group that first used a different name but is currently called the Arakan Rohingya Solidarity Salvation Army, or ARSA. And ARSA attacked security posts along the border, which led to killings of maybe a dozen police or security officers in both instances, which then provided an opportunity for the security forces in Myanmar to launch security operations in northern Rakhine State, in which they were targeting not just the people who may have been responsible for those attacks, but basically looking at the entire civilian population in those areas as the enemy. After the first wave, over about 180,000 people left for Bangladesh. And in the second wave, as I'm sure you know, it's been over 600,000 people who left. And the reasons include villages being burned down, killings of people, both by the security forces and also by Rakhine militia groups working together with the security forces, and also rape and fear. So in cases where villages weren't explicitly targeted, people, of course, got the word from other places about what had been happening and felt that it wouldn't be safe for them to stay. Thus, we've got an enormous population who are now across the border in Bangladesh. The NLD government is only part of the government. If you know much about Myanmar politics, the military still has a lot of control over the government and certainly over security operations. So the NLD government has no control to stop what the security forces do during a security operation. That said, there's still a lot of things that the NLD government could do. They certainly control what's happening in areas where there's not conflict, and they have control over some of the messaging, right? And what we have seen is that the NLD government has not really tried to change the narrative that was brought up in the film that Muslims are a threat in the country, not just the Rohingya, but that all Muslims in the country are somehow a threat, a population threat, a terrorist threat, a threat to Buddhism, a threat to the existence of the nation as a whole. And because that narrative has really not been challenged by the government, it has been allowed to spread among the population. And people who didn't necessarily hold those views before have kind of come to internalize or suspect that some of these things may actually be true. And so that's something that I'm very concerned about and have been writing about. Thank you.
Thanks. A couple thoughts on the film in general. I think first, as you said, this is really the prelude to what is now happening. I think one of the strengths of it is that it does capture the entire system of discrimination and segregation that has existed long before the current violence, a system that we have called apartheid, as the film did. And I think, you know, the totality of it, it's really difficult to even get your head around, in that in terms of access to education, in terms of access to healthcare, the simple ability to move around, everything has been restricted for really since 2012 and the violence that happened in 2012. You hear so many stories, and some of this was highlighted, but of people who need emergency medical care and they can't get to a hospital because you have to get authorization from the local authorities simply to move. Then you have to be escorted by local authorities to get to a hospital. If you actually do get to a hospital, there is a ward specifically for the Rohingya. So they're segregated even inside a hospital from other populations there. So again, this is an entire system of apartheid that has existed for years. And that, going even further back, relates to the stripping of citizenship in the early 80s. And then the other thing, just to add, you covered it well, but I mean, the current violence that started in the 25th of August with the attacks by Arsa then has been, of course, an escalation from anything that we have seen in the past, in terms of both the scale of the violence and some of the methods that have been used by the military and the security forces more generally. I've spent a lot of time in Bangladesh over the last 6 months documenting this, speaking with hundreds of people who've made it across, and you see a very consistent pattern of the military and the border guard police surrounding villages, and then as people attempt to run away, being fired upon, often from behind. I've interviewed dozens of children, 12 and under, who made it to Bangladesh after fleeing for a week with gunshot wounds. MSF has treated several hundred people with gunshot wounds. Other hospitals have likewise treated several hundred with gunshot wounds. And this is people who made it after fleeing for over a week through the mountains. MSF did a very detailed epidemiological study that indicated a conservative estimate of 6,700 people killed violently in the first month alone of the crisis. And again, they're very clear that this is a conservative. The scale is likely significantly higher. One of the numbers that jumps out of that particular survey, I can't remember, 720 or 750, but children under the age of 5 that were killed, mostly by gunshot wounds, though we also have documented a large number, particularly of the elderly, people with disabilities, who, because they couldn't flee, were actually burned inside their homes when the military then set fire to the villages. One of the things that, from a documentation perspective, Amnesty and others are denied access to Northern Rakhine State. We have formally asked for authorization to go many times to the state authorities, the national authorities. We have been blocked. We obviously have access to a huge number of people in Bangladesh. One of the real game changers, though, is also satellite imagery, which we have used extensively to corroborate the stories of people in Bangladesh. And one of the things that the satellite imagery shows is just how targeted this operation has been. So there are a lot of villages that were mixed ethnic group, Rohingya in one area, Rakhine or another ethnic minority in another area. And what we see from the satellite imagery is that the burning is unbelievably targeted. I mean, you're talking about at times houses that are 5-10 meters apart, and an entire area is leveled, every last structure burned to the ground, every house, every mosque, every market, and then next to it, an area that is completely untouched and 100% still intact. And again, it shows, and the other thing that it shows is, this was the height of the rainy season when this happened. Burning's hard when it's pouring down rain, and every last structure in so many of these villages has been burned. And it's not a fire that's spreading from one house to another, because we can see again on these images that you have vegetation that's still intact between one house and another house. So it's not spreading. These are independent efforts to burn every single house. It takes time, it takes effort, it takes a lot of coordination. So again, I think there has been a lot of work by ourselves, by Fortify Rights, it's mentioned in this, Human Rights Watch, that shows just how sophisticated and targeted this operation was, and the scale and nature of crimes that ultimately have to lead to justice and accountability. The last thing I'll say for opening remarks is, the one thing I would slightly take issue with in the film is the UN has been deeply problematic in its response, but the UN is a symptom of a much wider problem. The UN has not been alone in failing to speak out forcefully enough and to take action forcefully enough. The US government, the European Union, basically any political body around the world has not done enough in response to this. The failures of the UN, to me, are representative of a much wider failure of the international community to respond to this appropriately, to do things like an arms embargo or targeted financial sanctions on officials who are implicated in rights violations. So the UN is part of the problem, but it's not, it's, to me, it's a symptom of a much wider problem in terms of the response.
You know, there's not an awful lot you can say substantively that would add to what was already been said, but I think it really is critical to emphasize over and over and over again the depth of just what has been happening. You know, this was it was sad to watch that, but if you look at what's been happening since especially August of last year, it pales in comparison to anything that was shown in that film. They talked about 140,000 people being put into internal displacement camps. As Dr. Frank said, some almost 700,000 people have fled to Bangladesh since last August alone. Now, we had meetings with various people, officials of the Bangladesh government, who said that, you know, in the beginning of August, they were seeing military buildups by the border between Bangladesh and Myanmar, and they could see a lot of military activity going on. So when everything broke in the end of August, when these attacks allegedly took place, the Burmese military was already prepared for its operations. They started immediately. There's a village that our chairman has been in touch with people from that village called Tulathang. They told us later in their camps in Bangladesh, that people came to the village the day before the outbreak and told people, do not go out and work in your fields tomorrow. You need to come and you need to be registered. You need to come out and we'll have people coming in and taking names and having everyone registered for a census. Well, when the news broke, you know, it was not so much that people were being registered for the census, but being separated out and then taken out into the fields and disappeared. You know, there were some people left in the village, but the rest of them never came back. And when these people saw what was happening, they decided it's time to leave. So there was something like 1,700 people, Rohingya, in that village prior to that. And now they're essentially all gone. You know, if you talk to people, you know, you said you've been there. A couple of months ago, I was at a program with a Turkish journalist. And he had shown pictures of everything that he was taking. He spent 3 weeks in the refugee camps. And he was saying, he was showing pictures of different people in a hospital. And he said, you know, what do you notice that's sort of common about all of these pictures? So, you know, if you look at them, every one of the teenage kids like maybe 12 to 15 years old, they all had broken legs. And he said, finally, I was wondering about that. And why are so many young teenagers in hospital with broken legs? So he had his interpreter ask. And each one of them, from different villages, were saying, well, when the military came in, they took all the people of our age group, lined us up on the road, made us lie down, and then they rolled an army truck, an army lorry, over all of our legs. And they told us, we're not going to kill you, but if you come back, we will. This is just a warning to you. Leave and do not come back. There was an exhibition over at the Senate a couple of weeks ago. Some photographs of what's going on in the camps in there. And at the opening ceremony, they had a number of senators who had been to the camps and been to Burma. Now, a film like this could not happen now because, you know, we've heard about the Iron Curtain, the Bamboo Curtain. Well, there's, I don't know if you want to say, a Saffron Road curtain that has been blocking off any access into Myanmar itself. So there's no news organizations, there are no NGOs, no one else can go in and report on what's going on. But there is that satellite imagery. Last year, several of the US senators had gone over for a visit, and they were initially told that they could go anywhere in the country that they wanted, and they could go and visit in Rakhine State. After they got there, they said, oh no, we're sorry, but situation too dangerous, you can't go into Rakhine State. But they allowed them to go to Sitwe. And they could see where the ghetto, for all intents and purposes, was where the Rohingya people had been forced to live. And these senators, essentially compared this to like the Warsaw ghetto in the 1940s. They compared it to concentration camps in Nazi Germany. They said they were appalled. They couldn't believe the conditions that they saw. And this was the place where the Burmese authorities apparently felt secure enough that, you know, well, we can take these senators there and it's not going to be a problem. We'll let them see it. But they said, you know, we could not imagine how much worse it could have been in other places. The camps in Bangladesh, you know, it's just 700,000 people in a country which is one of the poorest in the world. They're living in conditions, you know, close to the sea where it's very, very difficult. There was one road coming up from the port that would allow people to come in and bring supplies. Well, we even tried an initiative with the Burma Task Force, working with them, working with the Bangladesh government. They had asked us, can we get approval from the U.S. to helicopter in supplies so that we don't have to go through a choke point of a single one-lane road trucking everything up to the camps. Well, we worked on that, and we're delighted to say that we saw a great deal of enthusiasm for doing something like this in our U.S. Congress. But when we went back to the Bangladesh government, they said, well, you know, we've got it all sorted out. Our army has built a new road, so, you know, we really need to do that. But, you know, we'll let you know if we want to do this again. It was such an appalling condition that you cannot imagine. And now, you know, we're being told the monsoon season, I don't know if any of you have ever lived in Southeast Asia, but when the monsoon comes, there's nothing that compares with it. You know, you can see monsoon rain, and it's just, it's not like a rainy day here in Washington. The monsoons last for months, and it's just unrelenting. Most of the places where these camps have been built have been stripped of all vegetation. So you see what's happened in California a couple of months ago with the fires, and now there's heavy rains and they're worried about mudslides and things just floating away. Well, you know, think of that in Myanmar, in Bangladesh, where it's at sea level, where these areas are under seawater for just regular flooding. And now the vegetation has been stripped off. People are living in all of these camps. Someone was telling me that, you know, there are two separate, there's a source of water for drinking, and then there are the latrines. But they were saying when the monsoon rains come, it's going to be almost impossible to separate the drinking water from the wastewater. 700,000 people, think about the disease that's going to spread through all of that. You know, I mean, it's just, it really is unimaginable. And we can't really comprehend exactly the depths of this crisis. That film is a sort of an appetizer, but it doesn't really express all of this. You know, one of the things that we can talk about this a little bit more later, they included in there the pictures of Aung San Suu Kyi when she came to Washington. This is part of the problem. She was surrounded by, at the time, it was John Boehner, who was the speaker. You had Mitch McConnell, you had Hillary Clinton, all the other leadership. You know, these people welcomed Suu Kyi and gave her the expectation and the hopes that she's going to turn things around. And you know, we've had several times that we've had Rohingya Americans coming here, meeting with people in the Congress. And they all would talk about how they and their families were supporters of Suu Kyi and the NLD for years. And when she was released from prison, and when they said they would have elections, and when she was elected, you know, these people were delirious with happiness, the Muslims, the Rohingya, and saying, you know, now we can finally get somebody who understands us, somebody who's fighting for human rights and has made a career of fighting for those human rights. And she has been, you know, if you saw her with the British journalist from the BBC, and she's saying, well, you know, what about the Buddhists? There are Buddhists who have been displaced as well. Well, as that shown in that film, in Sidway, you have the camps that were built for the Muslims, you have the camps that were built for the Buddhists. You know, it's like living in a Hoover City, a ramshackle community, as opposed to building, you know, which is adequate and decent housing. There is no comparison. And yet, I don't know if any of you remember a couple of weeks ago, former governor, U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Bill Richardson, he had been asked by Aung San Suu Kyi, whom he has known for decades. She asked him to be part of a commission that was going to look at how you can implement the recommendations of the Kofi Annan Commission, how to resolve some of this. Well, he went to Myanmar, and within, you know, a couple of days, he publicly broke with her because he said, this is a whitewash. She absolutely refuses to even use the word Rohingya, or Rohingya, or however else you want to pronounce it. She refuses to say it one way or the other. She refuses to acknowledge that there's an issue or a problem. And that, you know, the whole thing in his eyes was a whitewash. And he said, I'm not going to be party to this. I resign. And I'm giving up my friendship with Suu Kyi that has left